It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, May 21st, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. Congress boosts U.S. aid to Ukraine.
Future of America's security and core strategic interests will be shaped by the outcome of this fight.
President Biden looks to strengthen the U.S. influence in Asia.
America's alliances in Europe and in Asia keep us, and I would argue, the world strong and secure.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
The U.S. investment in Ukraine's fight against Russia is now funded for several months. Before adjourning for the week, the Senate voted in a big bipartisan display for a $40 billion package in military and humanitarian relief. Since the start of the invasion in February, Congress has authorized more than $50 billion for Ukraine.
Aid for Ukraine goes far beyond charity. The future of America's security and core strategic interests will be shaped by the outcome of this fight.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has been a strong advocate for Ukrainian assistance, joining with Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. McConnell last weekend traveled to Kyiv as a sign of solidarity. And while the votes for Ukrainian aid have been overwhelmingly bipartisan, all of the opposition has been from Republicans. 11 Senate Republicans voted no this week. A House vote on the aid package last week ended with 57 Republicans voting no. Most of that opposition is about the cost, with crisis mounting here at home and worries about oversight. Republican Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, the first Ukrainian-born member of Congress, is pushing for more aid. I talked with her about what Ukraine needs, what the U.S. should be providing, and the disagreement with some members of her party.
You know, if you think about it, you know, we've been dragging our feet for a while, right? And I think it's like in any crisis, if you are going to, you know, deal with that, you need to deal decisively. Otherwise, you know, procrastination and being reactive will always cost more. So we haven't really done enough before. We know the previous package didn't really have enough security assistance. It's only a couple billion from 13.6. You know, so I think, you know, that really escalated now crisis even further. And it's not just crisis becoming in Europe, but, you know, worldwide. You know, and it did, you know, really destabilize now the world economy and will create hunger and riots and a lot of problems that are happening right now. So I think, you know, this is a little bit in the better direction, you know, because we do have more, you know, actually, you know, security assistance, military aid, much bigger percentage of it. I would say probably should be even more percentage-wise, but it's better. It's much better. It's meaningful. It's something that will make a difference if we want to de-escalate the crisis. So I think this is very important. This is a very crucial time because if they don't really stop the, you know, Russians and really not really drag them to the table, it's going to be world on fire before the end of the year.
We've heard from Pentagon officials, from intelligence officials, that there is sort of a preparation here for what could be a very long conflict, potentially months longer of a conflict, if not longer. So how many more sort of the, you know, this is $40 billion, about half of it, a little bit more than half of it going to security spending. Is that going to be enough, or do you expect Congress is going to take this up again?
Well, I think, you know, if you think about it, about $10 billion goes to Ukrainian military. I think it should be much more than that, because the more it goes to Ukrainian military, the faster this contract, you know, conflict is going to be de-escalated. To tell you the truth, security assistance, military aid is a humanitarian assistance, because that is the only way, you know, for Ukrainians to stop Russians, and then we can have a negotiations, you know, of peace and how we can bring the international order back. If they're not help as much fast and as decisive, then, you know, this conflict will continue, and it will be causing a lot of problems, not just in Ukraine. It's Middle East, Eastern Europe, Moldavia. You know, we'll have problems in Baltics and Georgia, you know, and a lot of issues are going to be coming up. So it's not just in Ukraine. So I think it's an interest of everyone, you know, for Ukrainian army to be properly equipped to really stop this aggression and invasion. And then, you know, we have, you know, a chance maybe to have some kind of discussion, because Russia is not ready for it yet. I think if Ukrainians have a very strong offensive, Russia will get to the table.
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about that, those spending bills, because as you know, the opposition, and there's not been a lot, but all of the opposition that has come from Republican lawmakers in the House and Senate. Have you spoken to your colleagues on the Republican side about their opposition and, you know, what their concerns are, and you're able to maybe explain why these types of funding measures are so important?
Well, I think, you know, one thing I think, you know, I didn't like personally how Nancy Pelosi threw this package kind of last second on Republicans. I don't think that was very good and very wise to do that. You know, I think, you know, in a package like that, you want to work more with people and have more bipartisan support. There are some people with different views, which is okay. You know, we're a very diverse party. You know, there are some people concerned with oversight, and I have myself concerns with oversight. I push for hearing and actually have streamlining some of the processes we just push on administration during our classified hearing that I actually co-chaired, and ranking member and chair of oversight committee let me co-lead that, you know, yesterday, because there are some legitimate concerns we have to address. I have the same concern, and I'm working to address them. But also, I think we need to work with another side, and I don't think Speaker Pelosi is always, you know, work very well with Republicans. A lot of Republicans understand that it's important to get it moving. The time is of the essence. You know, so we move it to the Senate to address these things in the Senate, and then we can do through oversight function, which I personally planning to do too, to make sure that, you know, we do have proper oversight of all of this assistance.
Some of the concerns, though, from Republicans aren't just oversight, right? Some of them believe that this is maybe escalatory, that it increases the likelihood of a wider conflict. Do you share those concerns?
Well, I think the conflict has already escalated pretty much. So I think most people do understand that to de-escalate it now, we have to really help Ukrainians to stop this aggression, because it's been escalating. It's escalating quite a bit with blocking the ports and everything else. It will escalate. I don't know if you saw David Beasley from World Food Program having an article that, you know, the blocking of all of the food in the ports of Odessa is going to destabilize over 24 countries, Middle East, you know, Northern Triangle. It's going to Sri Lanka. It's going to be world on fire. 24 countries will be in really bad, bad situation. So hunger is also a weapon of mass destruction and will bring a lot of instability. So I think the conflict is already escalatory. What's happened in Moldova and Poland and in Europe, that's why you see some of the countries now want to join NATO. So I think it is escalated because we didn't have decisive action. If we would have done things a year ago, what we're doing right now, we would not have had a war. But we are where we are. So the war will get larger, or we will constrain it. And the only way to do it, you know, the cheaper way for us to help Ukrainian military to stop the aggression, you know, that is just from pragmatic standpoint, without even looking at humanitarian and all other issues of, you know, and our commitments to, you know, to Budapest Memorandum or anything else, you know, or just being as a humane perspective, just from a pragmatic standpoint. You know, right now, timely and proper security assistance, military assistance is the only way to de-escalate the situation. You know, so I think we just have to be smart and have to do that. And I think we're getting better at that.
Does this end with Ukraine having to cede any territory in the Donbass or Crimea?
Well, I didn't, you know, this is all up to Ukraine and Russia, how it's going to end, you know, and how they're going to decide that, you know. But I think in this very, you know, after all of this, you know, fighting how brutal this war, you know, the longer it continues, you know, it's very will be difficult, you know, for Ukraine to come to any agreements, because, you know, just because people, the toll, the human toll, the atrocities and the brutality of this war, it's really barbaric, killing women and children in the way in front of this, you know, adult man, you're looking at that, I mean, they have tears in their eyes. I mean, as a human being, it's just very difficult. So it's very difficult after taking so much losses, destroying the whole country, infrastructure. I mean, this is just unbelievable, the level of destruction. It's almost surreal just to say, oh, you know what, we have so many people died for nothing. You know, so if the more it continues, the harder it's going to be. But there are probably some compromises still can be done in some of other areas that maybe they can find common ground. But the sooner it happens, the more likely there is going to be some resolution that both sides can come together on.
I'll finish with some more of the news of the day, Congresswoman. Do you support the expansion of NATO with the ascension of Finland and Sweden?
I think, you know, in general, we have to rethink our worldwide security. Because if you think about it, you know, UN became a completely dysfunctional organization. Except issuing resolutions and doing talking points, they do nothing. They cannot organize humanitarian corridors. They cannot stop the wars. They cannot really deal with the, you know, with the crises like that. And, you know, it became a big bureaucracy. So I think we don't have an institution. So now everyone is looking, okay, if you become a member of NATO and one child in your country dies, the whole West is going to become for you and protect you. So if you're in Romania, your child died, you know, you're not set. We have all armies for you to help you. If you're in Moldova and your child died, got killed, well, too bad. You can, you know, everyone can get slaughtered. No one cares. All or nothing. It's a very dangerous situation we created. So I think we have to think about mechanisms, how we can enforce peace and stability, that no good aggressor cannot just come and slaughter a bunch of people. So I think this is a broader discussion. So I don't know if this discussion is going to happen now during the war. I completely understand why these countries are nervous. I totally understand them. They do not have fighting armies and capabilities what Ukraine has. I said there are really two capable, battle-tested armies there to stand against Russia, Ukrainian or American army. If we don't help Ukrainian army, we'll have to engage our army. That is the reality right now in Europe. So they understand their concerns. I understand that. But ultimately, that should be a discussion, a broader discussion.
I mean, because at the White House today, both the leaders of Finland and Sweden talked about the invasion of Ukraine as this watershed moment that changed the trajectory of their decades-long neutrality standpoint. So it seems to me like what you're sort of suggesting is countries are trying to find a way to get maybe a stronger assurance, and NATO may be one of those organizations that provides that.
Right now, it's the only one. But I think we also need to understand that it becomes a very, very complicated now situation, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do we do make sure is that, you know, it's, you know, because there's going to be a lot of politics, you know, to get join new members, and there's going to be a lot of drama and opposition, you know. But how can we assure, maybe rethink about it, how we can have peace and security, and maybe look at a different mechanism, also alternative, if not NATO, then some alternative mechanism to enforce stability and international order. Because also, you know, NATO can be very complicated with a lot of countries and a lot of politics, you know. So is it the best mechanism or not? But as of right now, for any country, it is the only mechanism that countries feel they can be protected. And it's unfortunate that we don't have any other alternatives. And this crisis showed that we don't. And I think that has to be fixed.
It's a good point. Congresswoman, I appreciate your time as always. And again, my best to you and your family as you deal with your duties here in Congress, and also obviously the stress of dealing with what many of your loved ones are going through. So my best to you, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Air Force One touched down in Seoul this week for the first time with President Biden aboard. The president is making his first trip in office to Asia with visits to South Korea and Japan, two key allies in the Indo-Pacific. It's part of the world the Biden administration and administrations past have pledged to focus on and reorient away from the growing influence of China. Still, the war in Ukraine is raging and remains the top foreign policy focus. Minutes before leaving the White House, President Biden even hosted the President of Finland and Prime Minister of Sweden to bolster those countries' bids for NATO membership.
America's alliances in Europe and in Asia keep us, and I would argue the world, strong and secure. They're how we confront the challenge of our time and deliver for our people today and harness opportunities for a better tomorrow.
So what do those Indo-Pacific alliances look like for the Biden administration? And will this trip help shape domestic goals? For that, I spoke with Ollie Wine, a senior analyst with the Eurasia Group's Global Macro Geopolitics Practice.
The U.S.-Japan alliance is the cornerstone of security in the Indo-Pacific. And so the U.S.-Japan alliance is a first order importance, and not only for the Biden administration, but I think that for U.S. administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, the U.S.-Japan alliance has been a first tier importance for the better part of the past 75 years. And certainly, you know, the alliance with South Korea is also critically important. And I think that the Biden administration perceives a real opportunity to make strategic inroads with South Korea now that South Korea is under new leadership. South Korea's previous leader had been a bit more cautious in striking a balance in managing ties with the United States and managing ties with China. But South Korea's new leader is much more decisively aligned with the United States. And importantly, South Korea's new leader seems to be much more willing to try and build bridges or mend fences with Japan. There seems to be a mutual feeling. And I know that the Biden administration will welcome that nascent rapprochement, because one of the biggest challenges for U.S. foreign policy in Asia has been this longstanding friction between Japan and South Korea. So you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. So the U.S.-Japan alliance is critical to U.S. policy in the region. The Biden administration will welcome the opportunity to engage with South Korea under new leadership, and sustaining those two alliances will continue to be of vital importance.
I thought it was interesting that the first stop that President Biden made in South Korea, literally right after getting off Air Force One, was to a major U.S. manufacturing plant. Mm-hmm. Does that tell us anything about where the partnership, the focus when it comes to countries like South Korea will be?
It tells us a lot. So right now, you know, right now the global economy is being convulsed by a series of crises. It still hasn't fully recovered from the coronavirus pandemic. Mm-hmm. It now is being roiled as well by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I think that those shocks, as well as longer percolating concerns in the United States, demonstrate that the United States is concerned about its ability to, or I should say it's concerned about its overdependence on certain countries for vital commodities. It's concerned about the hemorrhaging of its manufacturing, its sort of domestic manufacturing capacity. It's also, the global economy is also dealing with sustained inflationary pressures. And so I think it's not surprising that the president, you know, made that stop his first stop. I think he wants to signal a focus on reinvigorating not only America's semiconductor production. He wants to signal a desire for, or a focus on, getting advanced industrial democracies in and beyond the Indo-Pacific to join forces in bolstering stockpiles of vital technological inputs, vital, you know, commodities. He wants to emphasize the, you know, desire to revitalize America's manufacturing base, to get inflation under control. And so I think it's important that this, even though obviously the president is in Asia right now, he has a number of audiences, and a critical audience, of course, is the American public. And he wants to signal that the Biden administration's commitment to a new industrial strategy to revive manufacturing, that those plans continue apace. And so I think that it's not just symbolism. I think it really signifies the administration's priorities.
You know, we had talked a little bit about this off air, sort of every administration sort of wanting to pivot, make that pivot to this region, right? Make sure that the U.S. influence remains robust, given China's influence. World events seem to always change that. And Jake Sullivan was asked about that this week before the president departed, about how do you keep the focus here, at least from the Biden administration's view, trying to show this sort of interdependency? How does that work?
It's challenging, to say the least. And just, you know, by way of a little bit of historical context, as you said, we were talking a little bit off air, and I discovered recently, I suspect it came as a surprise to me. So even though the pivot to Asia, the attempted pivot to Asia, or the rebalance to Asia, even though it's most often seen as having originated during the Obama administration, the effort actually dates all the way back to the George W. Bush administration. So when the George W. Bush administration took office in the early months of 2001, it was actually focused on how to reorient U.S. foreign policy towards Asia. And then, of course, the terrorist attacks of 9/11 happened. And then naturally and understandably, U.S. foreign policy became more focused on the Middle East. It became more focused on counterterrorism. So the Bush administration had events intrude. The Obama administration announced that it wanted to pivot or rebalance. And then, of course, we had the devolution of the Middle East into chaos with revolutions across the Middle East and North Africa. We had Russia's incursion into Ukraine and annexation of Crimea. So the Obama administration, it tried rebalancing, I think haltingly so. I think that the Biden administration is obviously fully cognizant of that history. And it wants to be the administration that says, look, previous administrations have tried to pivot or rebalance somewhat haltingly or unsuccessfully. We want to be the administration that really makes this a pivot or rebalance work. But obviously, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it really complicates that effort. And I think that certainly in the short term, I think that the bandwidth and the energy and focus of the United States' foreign policy apparatus is principally consumed with with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Interestingly, just in terms of timing, the Biden administration unveiled its Indo-Pacific strategy in early February, just I think about 2 weeks or maybe under 2 weeks prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It was a very ambitious strategy, but it got overshadowed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So one of the purposes of this trip is to demonstrate, and I think against the backdrop of a flurry of diplomacy this month. We had the U.S. ASEAN summit in Washington recently, the president making a multi-day trip, stopping in South Korea and Japan. And so it's very important for the administration to demonstrate that even though in the short term, necessarily, its attention is going to be principally preoccupied with developments in Eastern Europe, the administration wants to signal to allies and partners, including, importantly, in Europe, it wants to signal that its medium to long term focus remains the Indo-Pacific and remains strategic competition with China.
How worrisome is North Korea, as we sort of talk about all of this attention on Ukraine and Europe right now? Obviously, there is a belief that maybe before people listen to this, maybe after people listen to this, there could be a new missile or nuclear test by North Korea. Is that troublesome, or is that sort of more of the same?
Both. I guess I would say both. I mean, I would say it is more of the same in the sense that, you know, North Korea perennially feels attention deprived. And I don't mean to sound facetious in saying that, but North Korea, it wants to be paid attention to. It doesn't want to be ignored. And the principal way, you know, given that it is economically impoverished, it's diplomatically isolated, the principal way in which it can command the attention of leaders across the world stage is to conduct additional missile tests, conduct additional nuclear tests. And as your question gets to this concern, there are indications from U.S. intelligence, from South Korean intelligence, there are indications that North Korea is imminently preparing for some kind of test, potentially even its seventh nuclear test. We don't know. But it wouldn't be surprising if North Korea were to conduct another missile test or perhaps even another nuclear test during President Biden's visit to throw a wrench. The Biden administration, of course, is going to be, or President Biden and his top advisors, they obviously are going to be talking about North Korea in discussions with their South Korean and Japanese counterparts. But I don't think they want North Korea to overshadow the conversations. I think that the conversations principally are going to be focused on a few topics. One, how to push back selectively against China's increasing assertiveness, how to bolster supply chain resilience, how to coordinate the response between the United States and its Asian allies and partners to deal with Russian aggression in Ukraine. Again, North Korean provocations will invariably come up. But I'll just make one last point. I mean, one of the challenges, not only for the United States, but really for, you know, for Japan, for South Korea, is that in dealing with North Korea, your options are really not, there aren't really many, quote unquote, good options.
Right.
You know, your options don't run the gamut from good to best. They really run the gamut from bad to catastrophic in dealing with North Korea. You're dealing with a very, very limited set of options. And so the real question, I think the dilemma for any administration is, do you acknowledge North Korea as a de facto nuclear power? And I think that doing so would symbolically be quite a defeat, even though there's a recognition that North Korea, it is a nuclear power. So what do you state rhetorically? How, if at all, do you modify North Korea's behavior? And just to demonstrate how difficult it is to induce changes in North Korea's behavior, North Korea has finally acknowledged that it's dealing with a coronavirus pandemic outbreak. It appears to be quite a severe outbreak in North Korea. And despite having acknowledged that severe outbreak, thus far, North Korea has rebuffed offers of help from both South Korea and the United States and from the United Nations COVAX initiative. So What do you do in that situation? So there is a potential that North Korea could throw a wrench into the works. There's little room for agency in dealing with North Korea. And that's it's for that reason. I do imagine that particularly in the president's conversation with his South Korean counterpart, I imagine that there will be some conversations about strengthening nuclear deterrence in the region, about strengthening bilateral military cooperation between the United States and South Korea. But it is a perennial challenge. It is a increasingly vexing challenge for any policymaker.
So let me finish on that thought, because the last thing that the president is going to do in Japan is this summit with the Quad. That's Japan, India, the United States, and Australia. It is not a NATO type alliance. It is a cooperative, but it's not NATO, right? Is there a desire for something like that, for a sort of Article 5 protection in the Indo-Pacific?
I mean, thus far, I haven't seen any indications, even in the United States, for a sort of for a desire to sort of convert the Quad into a formal alliance. And I think, if anything, I would say, you know, my sense is that the leaders of each of the four Quad leaders, they like the flexibility in the current configuration of the Quad. What the advantage of the current configuration is that it continues to expand. So it continues to, we see the four Quad countries, they continue to deepen all kinds of cooperation, you know, military, diplomatic, economic, and so forth, but without some of the burdens that are associated with and inherent in a formal treaty alliance. And so my sense, and if you look at a country such as India, you know, India is, you know, India takes pride in preserving its freedom, its policy autonomy. And I think that India, for example, might be hesitant to be boxed in with a formal treaty alliance. And so my sense is that the four countries, they will continue to develop multifaceted cooperation quite vigorously. I think that we'll see many manifestations of that cooperation at the Quad Leader Summit in Tokyo. But my sense right now is that short of a very marked deterioration of the security environment that might necessitate shifting to an alliance, I think that all four Quad leaders will want to maintain the flexibility in that arrangement.
And in that point, you don't see the Quad expanding, South Korea joining or Vietnam or any country like that?
My sense is that it's not clear to me right now that the Quad would formally expand, or if it were to include an additional member, I guess it would have to be the pentagon or a hexagon, if it were.
Right. I know what you'd call it. Yeah.
Additional member. But I do think that, and I think that given historical, you know, suspicions and distrust between Japan and South Korea, I think that Japan might be a bit nervous about expanding it to South Korea. But I do think that we will see, at least informally, more robust coordination and cooperation between the Quad and South Korea and other Indo-Pacific, you know, countries. So I think that we should expect to see that collaboration increase, albeit informally. And again, South Korea under a new leadership, it is going to work much more vigorously to strengthen its relationship with Japan, strengthen its relationship with the United States. So I think that South Korea, even though not a member of the Quad, it's going to play an increasingly important role in America's Indo-Pacific strategy.
Really good information, Ali. Appreciate it very much. We'll continue to have these conversations as we look at the world and the U.S. role in it. Appreciate your time, as always, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, President Biden wants the Senate to act fast to bring Finland and Sweden under the NATO umbrella. We'll talk with Fox News congressional correspondent Chad Pergram about that fast approaching debate and the process for entering a new treaty. And Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Krossauer gets us set for Tuesday's primary in Georgia and other SEC states. Until then, I'm Jared Halpern. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.